Welcome to this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, the chairman of the Humanities Forum, which organized today's event. We also welcome our listening audience, both online and on the radio, and we invite everyone to visit us at www.commonwealthclub.org. It's my pleasure to introduce our speaker today, talking about the mind-body connection. Eric Nelson will be speaking. He is the media spokesman and legislative advocate for Christian Science in Northern California. His media work entails keeping in touch with news editors, producers, reporters, and various issues relating to the practice of Christian Science. His legislative work on both the state and federal level involves the legal accommodation of the practice of Christian Science, especially as it relates to healthcare. And that's our short version. Issue here is an ancient one, obviously. Plato discussed it. His analogy, as we say in the lead-up to this, his analogy was that the mind is like the charioteer and the body is like a chariot run by two or three horses, depending upon which version of the analogy it is, and that each of these different things drives our movement forward, but that the mind is a charioteer and the body is a chariot in a way so that there's a duality, and Plato's always been accused of being dual on this subject. Well, it's very interesting to argue because, fascinatingly, modern science is very unitary, and it's that the body creates everything that we experience. So from a totally different point of view, my analogy on this is, as I said to Eric, my analogy is if you wanted to study genealogy and you ignored the fact that the Mormons have the best genealogical records of all, it's to ignore people who specialize for their own reasons in something that we all discuss. So I want to get the specialist point of view on this. It's Eric Nelson on the mind-body connection.
Thanks very much for your great introduction and also for the invitation to be here tonight. I should mention I am a card-carrying member of the Commonwealth Club, if that adds any credibility to my talk tonight. I don't have my card with me, but trust me on that one. And also, please bear with me. This is the first time I've given this particular talk, so I will be working from notes. I'll do my best to look up as often as possible, but I will be working from some notes. One thing that George didn't mention in his introduction was that a long time before I became a spokesperson for Christian Science here in Northern California, I spent 5 years working for a company that makes life-size robotic dinosaurs. And then about 7 or 8 years working for a company that makes videos for the cruise line industry. So my backup is, if you don't find anything I say tonight particularly interesting, at the end of my comments you can ask any questions about mass extinction or paleontology or best deals on cruises to Alaska, whatever you like. So sky's the limit tonight. My guess is, though, that the reason you're here tonight is because of your interest in the mind-body connection, which is just perfect because that just happens to be the title of my talk tonight. I'd like to begin by taking a poll, and this will sound like sort of a silly poll, but please just play along. How many of you have ever found yourself turning red when you get embarrassed? Okay, at least half the room, okay. How many of you have ever felt your heart beating a little bit faster when you're frightened or startled? Okay, that's great. You played along. What we've proven here is that, and I know that's not a scientific poll, but what we've proven is that there actually is a mind-body connection, and you all have experienced it time and time again. What I'm going to do tonight, though, is explore the nature of this mind-body connection from my perspective as a Christian Scientist. That is, as somebody who relies entirely on spiritual means for my health care and physical healing in lieu of conventional medical care. I'd also like to explore some of the practical applications of this connection. And when I say practical applications, what am I talking about? Well, what I'm talking about is how some very good friends of mine, Christian Scientists, have used their understanding of the mind-body connection to cure not only red faces and beating hearts, but some very serious medically diagnosed conditions as well. And by the way, I should mention that it may sound tonight like I'm plugging Christian Science, and that's really not the purpose of my talk tonight. I'm not here to promote. I'm not here to convert anyone. I'm just here to share my perspective on this mind-body connection from a particular vantage point, so you can rest easy. I actually had a conversation with an editor of a newspaper, a prominent newspaper, and it wasn't until half an hour in the conversation, and she wouldn't tell me what faith she was. She said, I needed to be sure that you weren't going to convert me before I told you. So rest assured, that's not why we're here tonight. Now, I said I was going to share some experiences of some friends of mine, but what I want to start off with is sharing my own story. Now, this is something that happened to me many years ago. I was about 14 or 15 years old, and I found myself stranded and alone on the side of a mountain. I had multiple internal and external injuries. What had happened was I just slid about 1,000 feet down a very steep, a very rocky, and a very icy slope. The fall left me with two severely broken legs, a broken arm, internal bleeding, hypothermia, and a pretty banged up face. It was not a pretty picture. I had no one to turn to. I didn't have any painkillers, no bandages, and I had very little hope of rescue. But what I did have was some practical understanding of prayer, and using the vernacular of tonight's discussion, the mind-body connection. So for the next 3 or 4 hours, that's what I did. I prayed. Now, meanwhile, the buddy I was hiking with, it was just one other hiking with me, he couldn't see how far I'd fallen, and he frankly had no idea if I was dead or alive. So he made his way down the mountain to get some help. And by the way, there's no need to worry. The fact that I'm telling you this story tonight, you pretty much know how it comes out. So now, thankfully, I had been brought up attending my local Sunday school. And in this Sunday school, I learned that regardless of the severity of the situation, I could rely on God, or what Christian scientists often refer to as divine mind, for my recovery, for my healing, for my help, and for my rescue. And this brings up some important distinctions that I'd like to highlight between Christian science and what many people think about the mind-body connection. For instance, Christian science is not positive thinking. As I was lying there on the side of the mountain, I wasn't simply wishing or hoping the injuries that I suffered and the pain that I was experiencing would just magically go away. Christian science is also not mind over matter. Trying to use a human brain to manipulate a physical body, a broken leg, a beat up face, whatever the situation is, that has never worked for me. And frankly, I don't think it ever will. And finally, it's important to highlight that Christian science is not faith healing. Now, I know those words have all different kinds of connotations. One of those connotations is the idea that whenever something bad happens, like a slide down a steep, rocky mountain, that it was meant to be. It's God's will, and that it's our job just to do the best we can to deal with it. Well, I'm not here to comment on anyone else's religious beliefs or practices, but what I can tell you is that the idea that God either causes or allows bad things to happen is not what I have been taught as a Christian scientist, and it certainly hasn't been my experience. I've seen plenty of evidence that God, divine mind, is capable of creating and causing only good. Okay, well, if it's not positive thinking, if it's not mind over matter, if it's not faith healing, then what is it? How do Christian scientists characterize the mind-body connection? Well, for me, it begins with a realization, and I'll use the biblical term, revelation. A revelation that the essence of whatever problem I'm dealing with is not in the least bit physical, but fundamentally and exclusively mental. The next and perhaps most important step is the willingness to give up what I think for what God or divine mind knows about me and sees in me. That's the Christian science take on the mind-body connection. Now, this process of exchanging a limited, I'll call it material, view of things for a more spiritual view is what I referred to earlier as prayer. Prayer is the be-all and end-all of metaphysical treatment in Christian science. There's no laying on of hands, no incantations, just fervent, humble prayer. And that's where we left off on our story, with me sitting on the side of that mountain, praying like the Dickens. Well, eventually, I told you this story has a nice ending. You knew it would turn out okay. Eventually, I was airlifted off the mountain, and I was taken to a nearby hospital. Now, because of the extent of the injuries I had suffered, it seemed like a good idea for me to go ahead and have emergency surgery. Now, does this mean I all of a sudden stopped praying? Obviously not. I kept praying. While the medical staff tended to my various physical needs, not only did I pray, but my parents prayed as well. They wanted to do what was best for me. Their top priority was for me not to be in pain. As I mentioned, I was suffering from some pretty severe abdominal bleeding, internal bleeding, which my doctors said would require immediate surgery. But a rather interesting thing happened when they came out of the operating room. As they were speaking to my parents, they said, and these are their words, that somebody must have gotten in there before us because we couldn't find anything wrong. There was no evidence of internal bleeding. As far as my facial injuries were concerned, the original recommendation was for me to have plastic surgery. But instead, my parents and I together chose to rely solely on prayer for this healing. Within 3 weeks, all evidence of injury to my face had completely disappeared without even a scar. The broken arm healed rather quickly, and the two broken legs, which my doctor said would likely leave me unable to walk normally again, well, although this healing took a little bit more time, within maybe 5 or 6 months, I was leading my high school marching band as their drum major, and have since walked to the top of Half Dome and Mount Whitney and across the Grand Canyon in a single day. And I need to clarify, because that's bad English, I didn't do all three in a single day. One day I went up Mount Whitney, one day was I was reviewing my notes, and that's just bad. So let's be clear on that. I also, when I have a chance, I like to go for 100-mile bike rides every now and then. So obviously a complete recovery. Now I'm hoping that this experience that I just shared with you will help to dispel one very large myth out there, and that is that Christian Scientists don't go to the doctor ever, or that the Christian Science Church forbids its members from seeking medical attention ever. This is simply not true. Now, it is true that those who have been cured through the application of Christian Science, and I'm not just talking card-carrying church members here, but people of all different faiths, these folks have discovered, at least in some small measure, that the physical healings that they've read about in the Bible are actually true, and that they too can rely on spiritual means for their health and well-being without the use of medicine. But this does not mean that they have anything against doctors. The fact that I haven't been to a doctor in over 30 years is not because I refuse to do so, but because I choose to rely on a system of healing that has proved to be consistently effective. If I ever felt I needed to go to the doctor again, I think I'd feel comfortable doing so without fear of repercussion, either from my church or, hopefully, from God. I'll check with him later on that one. Well, I'm going to tell you another story about a good friend of mine from right here in the Bay Area, and it will illustrate how she applied her understanding of this mind-body connection. This was some years ago, and she was involved in a rather serious car crash, and she was taken to the hospital. X-rays showed that she had broken her neck in two different places. She was told that she had to have surgery right away, that she would be immobilized for an extended period, and that there was no guarantee of success. Again, not a very pretty picture. Well, long story short, she decided that she would prefer to rely solely on prayer-based treatment in lieu of medical care for her recovery. Again, not because she thought that she would go to hell if she had surgery, but because she'd experienced many healings before utilizing these very same means. Despite her doctor's concerns and their opposition, they allowed her to be transferred to a Christian Science nursing facility. And here she received basic non-medical care, as well as prayer-based treatment from a Christian Science practitioner. Now, Christian Science practitioners are folks who devote their full time to the healing practice, and they're available to the general public, not just church members. I should also mention that they're not paid by the church. Some people say, well, I go to my pastor and he's free. How come I go to a practitioner and they charge? Well, the Christian Science Church does not employ these practitioners. They're paid by the patients who come to them for treatment, like my friend did. Well, getting back to her story, most of her time at this nursing facility was spent trying to gain a better understanding of what she described as her unbreakable relationship to God. And this was not just some happy thought that popped into her head. It was a reminder of a divine law that, despite appearances, she knew was actually governing this situation. Now, very long story short, I can tell you that within a day and a half, her pain completely went away, and she was able to sit up in a chair. Within a week, she was walking about without any assistance. A week after that, she went home. Within a month of this accident happening, she was out jogging. So how did this happen? Was it just magic? Well, as I say, I don't know all of the details, but my guess is that this is the natural result of my friend gaining a better, perhaps more correct view of God and his unfailing care for what he created. As I see it, this kind of inspiration and its effect on the body doesn't come from a human brain, but from God or divine mind itself. Well, as you can tell by now, you should be able to tell by now, most of my ideas about the mind-body connection have been informed by my study and practice of Christian Science. This is a religion that was founded way back in the 19th century by a woman named Mary Baker Eddy. But where did she get her ideas from? Well, lots of places, but there were two primary sources. First and foremost, Mrs. Eddy was a devout student of the Bible. In fact, it was the inspiration that she gained by reading the Bible that led to a pretty dramatic healing of serious internal injuries. This experience set the ball in motion in terms of her further study of the Bible and eventual discovery of what she termed divine or Christian science. Although she was familiar with many of the great philosophers, her most profound influence came from reading and thinking deeply about statements like this one from the book of Genesis. And this should sound fairly familiar for those of you who have read the Bible. And God said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness." So God created man in his own image. Male and female created he them. And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. We have no idea who wrote that, but we do know that it made a pretty distinct impression on Mrs. Eddy. In her book, Science and Health with Key to the Scriptures, which serves as a textbook of Christian Science, she writes, "In following the leadings of scientific revelation, the Bible was my only textbook. The Scriptures were illumined, reason and revelation were reconciled, and afterwards, the truth of Christian Science was demonstrated." Speaking of which, Mrs. Eddy's second source of inspiration came from her experience as a healer. For many years prior to her discovery, she explored and experimented with a wide variety of medical approaches to curing her own and others' physical problems, some conventional, some not so conventional. Ultimately, they all failed to bring about the lasting relief that she was hoping for. Now, I find it interesting that she didn't see these experiments as a kind of detour on her road to health and happiness, but as an integral part of her preparation. In Science and Health, she writes, "The author's medical researches and experiments had prepared her thought for the metaphysics of Christian Science. Every material dependence had failed her in her search for truth, and she can now understand why and can see the means by which mortals are divinely driven to a spiritual source for health and happiness." As I said, Mrs. Eddy experienced a rather remarkable healing through spiritual means alone. Eventually, she was able to effect similar cures on others, and taught them as well as others to do the same. Now, her contemporaries, and even some today, would characterize Mrs. Eddy's method of healing as a kind of mind cure, but she didn't see it as such. She made a very clear distinction between healing through a kind of mesmerism, that is, the utilization of one person's thought or mind to influence another's, and healing through what she termed the divine mind or God. In fact, she completely dismissed the human mind as a factor in the healing process. I'd like to read just a short excerpt of a letter that someone wrote to Mrs. Eddy that I think does a pretty good job of illustrating this distinction. Now, when I say the words, the power of mind, from this writer's letter, what he's referring to here is God, or mind with a capital M. Here's his letter. He says, "I should have died, but for the glorious principle you teach, supporting the power of mind over the body, and showing me the nothingness of the so-called pleasures and pains of sense. The treatises I had read and the medicines I had taken only abandoned me to more hopeless suffering and despair. Adherence to hygiene was useless. Mortal mind needed to be set right. The ailment was not bodily, but mental. And I was cured when I learned my way in Christian Science." Well, the healthcare method described by this writer continues to this day, with over 80,000 cases of healing having been published in the Christian Science Church's various periodicals. We're talking about everything from minor ailments to broken bones, heart disease, tuberculosis, Alzheimer's, AIDS, and cancer. All of these cases have been verified, and many of them were medically diagnosed. For instance, I'll share just one more short story about a friend of mine from Chico. I should mention that when I learned about this story from my friend, the story she was telling me didn't match at all the woman who was speaking to me. It was just a complete transformation of character. Although she had been raised as a Christian Scientist, her life had taken a lot of difficult turns, and she was no longer practicing the religion. It seemed as if one disease after another was piling up, culminating in her doctor telling her that she had untreatable stomach cancer, and there was little, if anything, that he could do for her. In her despair, she tried to commit suicide by ingesting a bottle full of prescription pills, and this put her into a coma where she laid unconscious for the next 5 days in a hospital bed. When she awoke, she found herself recounting all that she had learned as a child about God and her relationship to him. Within just 3 days, and to the complete astonishment of her doctors, she completely recovered from the effects of the overdose and asked to be released from the hospital. For the next 5 months, she worked every day with a Christian Science practitioner. As she tells it, and this is a quote from an account that she wrote up, she says, "There were more days than not when I felt very fearful and discouraged, but the dear practitioner continued to remind me daily of God's great love for me and of his healing power and presence in my life." Then one afternoon, she knew in her heart that she was completely healed. That was over 20 years ago, and she's not had a single recurrence of the cancer symptoms that had plagued her for so many years. You know, in my work as a media and legislative representative, I've spoken with a lot of people who have argued that Christian Scientists take this whole mind-body connection thing a little too far. But given the evidence in my own experience as well as the experience of so many others, I'd say that we could and perhaps should take it much further. Now, here I've been talking for 20, 25 minutes, and I have yet to answer perhaps the most fundamental question of them all within our context of the mind-body question tonight. It's a question that George asked at the top of the program, and that is, are we talking about two things or one? Is the mind and body two different things, or are they essentially one cohesive whole? Well, the short answer, speaking from the standpoint of Christian Science, is that they are not two, but one. One's view of themselves of the world around them, and perhaps most importantly, of God, is reflected or made manifest in one's bodily experience. As I said before, this is not positive thinking, but thinking based upon demonstrable principles and observable phenomena, informed by some pretty amazing physical healings that folks have been witnessing off and on for the last two millennia. Now, exactly how this understanding of the mind-body connection is applied practically is a discussion that would likely take longer than the time that we have remaining. But there is one point that I would like to highlight. It's the fact that physical healing in Christian Science is not about using a human brain to fix a material body. It's about being open to the moral and spiritual transformation that is absolutely essential for complete and lasting healing to take place. For me, putting the mind-body connection into practice just doesn't make me feel better. It actually makes me a better person. Hopefully, I've given you enough fodder for some good questions. But like I said at the beginning of my comments, if you want to ask about cruises to Alaska or dinosaurs, please feel free to do so. Thanks very much for your attention, and I'll open it up to your questions and comments.
All right. Thanks, Eric, for that introduction to a series of ideas. And I think before we go into the questions, I think I'd like to engage you in a series of questions about the basic ideas. And compare them to some other ideas.
Sure.
And see, you know, what sort of basic assumptions we're working with.
Great, okay? Great.
So there is in Hinduism the idea that life is Maya, that life is an illusion, mm-hmm. that this is just a projection of our minds.
Yeah.
I don't know if you're familiar with that idea mm-hmm. or not, but in mm-hmm. this case, if you're saying that this is the human life is a projection of our individual minds, mm-hmm. our bodies are a projection of our individual minds, or of the universal mind, you call it that.
Right, right. Well, and to make that distinction between, well, I'll call it the mortal mind and the divine mind, there's this mm-hmm. idea that there's many mortal minds, but in Christian Science teaches that there's actually one divine mind. One sort of fundamental difference there, I won't say that there aren't similarities that we find between different faiths and practices, mm-hmm. but one thing, Christian Science sometimes gets folded into a new thought, new age, some of these other sort of modern-day belief systems, if you will. Christian Science is exclusively Christian in its approach, meaning that Mary Baker Eddy's views about things, what informed her was exclusively Christian. She looked solely at the Bible, especially the example that she saw in the New Testament with the healings that Jesus effected, and said, I'm going there. That's my falling apple. It wasn't as if she was unaware of other faiths, and it's not as if we don't find some similarities with the other ones, but the teaching and the practice of Christian Science is decidedly and exclusively Christian in its approach.
Right. I recognize that. I'm just wondering, you know, let's go at it from a different point of view then,
sure.
and just say what the illusion is. Let's make the assumption that all the healings are accurate, instead mm-hmm. of discussing
sure,
whether
sure.
or not they actually take place or not. Let's just make the assumption that they're all accurate, because my interest, as those of you have heard me before, is in the basic assumptions, basic ideas behind them, and it's a lot easier just to assume that they're true. I think it's certainly true, for example, that the mind and the body have a peculiar relationship, at least. Mm-hmm. And that sometimes the mind wins, and it sounds to most people like the body wins. I don't think that that's opposed to what you say. You're just saying that there's a disconnect in a way mm-hmm. That allows that to take place. But an example that I often use is someone is dying, a parent is dying, and they say they're 87, 88 years old,
mm-hmm.
and they know that their body is finally not going to be able to take it anymore, and they have three or four children. And they want to see their children before they die. And one child is 10,000 miles away, you know, halfway around mm-hmm. the world doing something else. I think we all know experiences where that person is able to hold on to life
just yeah.
for 5 or 6 or 7 days until that child gets there. And the child gets there, they say goodbye, and the person dies, like mm-hmm. the next minute.
Yeah.
I think that almost everybody accepts. And there doesn't have to be anything miraculous about it, but the body seems to have a relationship with the mind, which isn't as simple as the body runs everything,
mm-hmm.
because the mind's desires can kind of push things around a little bit. I think most materialists would say, how much can they push? how much can it not push? And maybe that mind is just the projection of the body, but that argument is pretty tough in the case of that. Another example of everyday life that makes the discussion interesting is you're standing in a room alone doing something. You're facing this direction, and you suddenly say, somebody just walked into the room.
Mm-hmm.
You did not, you might be your ears, but in my case, that couldn't be because I have such bad hearing. But it might be some other sense, you know, of feeling the floor or something like that. But a lot of people say, I feel the emotions of another mm-hmm. mind. And they might turn around and see an animal rather than a human being.
Mm-hmm.
You know, another mind has just come in, but it's an animal looking. Or you might watch an animal, like a squirrel, doing its thing out in the lawn, and you're far enough away from it. And suddenly, the squirrel's looking up going, who's watching?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
You know, even the squirrels seem to be able to notice that another mind is paying attention to them. So that kind of common basis of mind-body experiences, mm-hmm. mind-body differences I'd like to go to. Now, the question that I think is fundamental to this approach is, you made the choice that there would be a certain amount of surgery when you're 14 or 15 and a certain amount
sure.
of not surgery.
Right.
Other people make no surgery at all and mm-hmm. still recover.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But the question is, if the mind, the divine mind, is responsible for everything, all the healing, then what is the role of the person who mm-hmm. fell off the mountain?
Right, you know, exactly.
And in what sense is it that you fell off the mountain? Was that part of the plan? And also the question is then, all the people that are ignored and not healed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think I know your answer.
Well, I want to know what you think the answer might be. This could be fun. No, I'm kidding. No. Good questions, one and all. And I'm trying to remember the two last questions that you gave about, if there's a divine mind. Basically, why did the bad thing happen in the first place, and what's my role?
Why did you slip? You know,
exactly.
Why was your mind distracted by something that you slid off the mountain?
Right, exactly.
I take it you weren't on a snowboard trying to do it.
No. I was not on a snowboard, I can assure you of that. I do have to say one of the small miracles that I didn't mention was the fact nothing happened to my teeth. My face was just completely splattered. Nothing happened to my teeth, and I had just gotten my braces off. That was my first thought was, oh, my gosh, my parents are going to kill me because they just put $3,000 into my mouth, and that's going to have to – anyway. So I could eat the apple that I had that actually survived, too, unbruised. So those are the small miracles that I didn't mention. So what's going on there? Honestly, George, that's a question that I have asked and struggled with more times than you can imagine. So one thing I want to make very clear here, and I hope it's clear, is that speaking for myself and maybe all Christian scientists, it's not as if they've got it down pat and aren't still thinking through things. It's not as if there's an answer for everything, like, oh, absolutely, God said this and it's just done. It's by no means a dogmatic approach. But on that particular question, one thought that has come to me not too long ago, thinking through that very issue, I think of the analogy of swimming. You know, I'm going to be a much better swimmer if I learn how to swim. If I go out there in the swimming pool and somebody throws me a life preserver every single time, sure, I'll be fine. I'll survive. Everything's great. I'll make it to the shore. I'll never drown. That's great. But my gosh, I'm so glad that somebody taught me to swim, because that got rid of the fear I have. If I fall into the pool, I'm not afraid. If I fall in the ocean, as long as the waves aren't too big, I'm not afraid. Now, does this mean God is playing some sort of cosmic trick on us and let's keep throwing this guy into the swimming pool until he learns how to swim and I'll withhold life mm-hmm. reservers? I don't see it as such, mm-hmm. but I do hold to the beginning of what I was saying, that I learn from these experiences, so the next time I face something similar, at least to a small degree, the fear is lessened. And to me, that's the key to my health and well-being, is being fearless. And each step in that direction is a good step, and I will take it, maybe not in stride, but I will hopefully recognize a lesson there.
All right. Well, that's a great place for another movement here on fearless. We probably have to come back to that. But if you take the divine mind as the creator of these mortal minds, I assume that it's the source. I'm not quite sure.
Actually, no.
Okay, so the mortal minds are?
As Mary Baker Eddy describes it, mortal mind is a term that she uses to describe something that actually has no real existence. Zero. What is zero? It's nothing. We had to come up with a word to describe that nothingness. Right. So really, mortal mind is her best shot at describing something that really has ultimately no substance, no reality, no real impact on our well-being.
All right, so it definitely is one of the ideas that this is that individuality basically is an illusion.
That's a good question. Individuality is an illusion. I would say
that's where some of the Hindu philosophers are.
Right, and I would say that one's experience is a reflection of their thought and their belief, specifically about God, not just about anything. Like, you know, the secret. We've all familiar with the secret that we sort of create our life, our being, the life that we want to have. And that sounds, for me, interesting and could be helpful to some. But to me, it's not about that. It's about living the life that God is causing me to be, not that I sort of want to be. Right. But going back to your question, because I've gotten off the point, if you could ask it again.
No, whether individuality is an illusion. But I think you answered it.
Okay.
You're saying basically that in some ways it is, but the fact that your experience of life, are your thoughts and your senses about this divine mind. And,
right.
And to the extent that you are in tune, I'm guessing here, but I have some knowledge,
sure.
In tune with that divine mind, then things work out smoothly. And when you're out of tune, it doesn't work so smoothly. Or you can physically suffer. Your body suffers in a way which reflects your being out of tune.
Yeah, being out of tune. Because one thing I would say fundamentally, because I do work as a practitioner, and others do come to me for treatment, and my assumption is that God created his creation in tune. So this idea that the creation can kind of get out of whack, that's something that I challenge as well. But going to your point, are we in tune or out of tune? Yeah, I do think that there are whatever discord, whether it's a financial problem or a physical problem, that at its root is what somebody is unconsciously or consciously choosing to believe about themselves and their relationship to God. Like I say, this is what I'm talking about is a fundamentally religious Christian approach here.
Right.
But that's what it comes down to. And I would say, too, as far as the being in tune part, going back to my point about, you know, spiritual and moral transformation, I do think that qualities such as compassion and patience and forgiveness and those kinds of things, qualities that we traditionally associate with Christianity and also other faiths, that those are essential to helping one be receptive to or be in tune with this divine mind.
All right, I'm going to ask a question I don't expect you to answer because it's been asked all along. But,
okay.
If there's a divine mind that is omniscient and omnipotent and knows, I don't know whether that's part of the theory
sure,
or not,
yeah.
if it knows everything about what's going to happen, then it knows what these mortal minds are going to do. And it has created all of the ones that do exist. And some of them seem to know how to stay in tune, and some can't stay in tune at all. Mm-hmm. And therefore, the explanation is required, why create the ones that can't do it?
Well, I'll throw out a couple of analogies there. And I'll use a mathematical one and a legal one. I don't know that the law of mathematics is particularly aware of every time somebody writes down 2 plus 2 is 7 and says, get it right. So I don't make that connection that there's an awareness of the law and the mistake in trying to achieve or understand that law. Same thing with a legal law, you know. We have no idea when we come up with a law, whatever it might be, don't stop, you know, stop at a red light or whatever. We have no idea who's going to benefit from that, how and why and what the circumstances are. Yet the law is there to be utilized, benefited from, healed from. So, you know, those are the best analogies I can think of.
Yeah. In both cases, it's human, you know, incapacities that cause the difficulty. And in this case, you're positing a mind that knows what it's doing.
Right. And I'm sure, going back to the math one, I don't think one of us, when we wrote down that 2 plus 2 is 7, we said, there's just no law of mathematics. It doesn't exist. I'm checking out completely. Yeah. Well, hopefully nobody said that. You kind of persist. You know, you went on the assumption that, no, maybe there's just something. And the suffering that's involved there is the F that you get on the test, as long as you insist, no, I had it right. So you open your – and who caused that F? Was it the law of mathematics? Was it your teacher? No, it was a mistaken belief that 2 plus 2 is 7. So basic analogy, but hopefully it gets us on the same page.
And I'm going to just restate the basic question or basic fundamental assumption that's difficult about that is some minds are created capable of – doing that correctly, and some minds are incapable of it because of their personality, because of other things, and this is the question that's very difficult to answer. But now let me switch over to something else, because that question I think is raised sufficiently for everybody.
Okay.
Fear. Mm-hmm. Say the idea is to get rid of fear. Well, how do you define fear? What is fear?
I don't know that I've ever been asked that question. How would I define fear? I don't know if it's so much a thing as a result of accepting consciously or unconsciously, accepting something is true that just plain isn't. okay? In a horror film, you go into a horror film and you're frightened. Oh my gosh! Well, you have accepted something as true that has no basis in reality whatsoever. That's fear. I would translate that to one's physical condition too. What we're really dealing with there is not the broken leg or the broken this or that. It's accepting something is true that really has no basis in the reality that the divine mind knows about its creation. So again, fear is just taking into one's thought, consciously or unconsciously, something that is just not true.
It's an interesting, you know, conclusion, because there are a lot of people, as you said, this isn't faith healing. This is a conclusion that the
right.
body with the broken leg
right.
is not really real. It's not really true.
Yeah, well, thank you for letting me clarify that. To say it's not real, I would say that it has no basis in truth, that it has no true substance, that it has no lasting quality. I think we need to find what that word real is.
Okay.
We too often call something real, and we're not dealing with the same definitions of that word. So
right.
I think we need to be clear on what, and when I say not real, that's shorthand. So thank you for letting me clarify that.
That's why I like to ask questions about definition.
Yeah.
In this case,
yeah.
real, if you're saying something that doesn't last, of course, no body lasts more than 150 years,
mm-hmm.
you know, and probably not that much, but I thought I'd give it a little leeway in case the future is better.
Yeah, that's good. Because yeah, people are going to check in on this
yeah,
talk
exactly.
in the future and say, well, George had it right. So, yeah, that's
so,
good.
So say 150 years. You know, if nothing that lasts that long is not real, that's another mm-hmm. way of approaching it. But in the meantime, all those physical things seem to follow law, seem to mm-hmm. follow practical rules. It may be that the mind can shift it, heal it, but mm-hmm. it also is true that doctors who have enough knowledge can come in and shift it and heal it better than mm-hmm. doctors who had less knowledge. Now, I'm not saying, for example, that doctors today have got all the knowledge. They know themselves mm-hmm. that they're inadequate information about lots of things.
Yeah.
But they have adequate information about many things, and they're in the middle on a whole bunch of stuff. So to me, current medicine is a little bit like, I mean, they've made great progress in the last 200 years of figuring out, but there's like, we don't have the blueprint for our bodies, right? And it's they're obviously extremely complex things. And they're trying to figure out this blueprint. And my analogy for a lot of things like this is a baseball game. If you weren't told what the rules of baseball are, and you went to a baseball game, how long do you think it would take you to figure out what the rules are just by watching the game? How many games do you think you'd have to watch before you said, oh, I know, there's three strikes and it's an out, and there's, you know, nine innings, and this hit means one thing. Okay, so you would, and this means a hit, and this means an out. I mean, it would take hundreds of games of an acute observer to kind of sort out what the rules were.
And a lot of hot
how
dogs.
How long do you think? Hmm?
A lot of hot dogs, too.
And a lot, yeah.
See, yeah.
Unless you paid attention to your body's needs. How long, if you were doing that, even if you figured out all the basic rules, how many games do you think you'd have to watch to figure out the infield fly rule? Those of you who know what the infield fly rule is, you know, under certain circumstances, there's two out and there's a pop-up. Even if the guy drops it, it's an out, and that's okay. So the infield fly rule would probably take a million games if you had no idea what the rule was, because it doesn't happen very often, before even the most acute observer would figure out what it is. So mm-hmm. that's my analogy for something like modern medicine. Mm-hmm. And one of the things, obviously, is they don't know what the mind can do, what the decision of the mind can do. But I think there's sufficient evidence. I mean, I think any time you get some new piece of information, you get really excited and say, this is the key to the whole thing,
mm-hmm.
right? Genes. Everybody got really excited when we figured out that there are genes and that they created certain things. And everybody was saying, if we just figure out what each gene is for, we can turn it on, turn it off, make everybody intelligent, you know, the kind of thing I was just asking, you know, if a divine mind was in charge, it could make everybody the way they wanted to. Why is there such a distribution of abilities and so on? They could all be obedient, you know, and if we go back to the Bible, you know, one of the stories that people don't argue about too much, but it's fascinating, is that, you know, in heaven, there were the angels, and one-third of them decided to follow Satan to say no, you know, because he didn't like staying there. He wanted to be disobedient more than to stay in heaven. That's a pretty hard argument to make about it, heaven being eternal, and then once you're there, you never leave again, because the original inhabitants got tired of it for one reason or another. And I think it's a story or an image, but it's an image of our minds having free will and wanting to say no, wanting
mm-hmm.
to say no, even for dumb reasons. Okay. So the question is, do you say yes for good reasons? Do you say no for dumb reasons, and so on and so forth?
Right.
So to go back to fear, if I have looked at fear and said, okay, what is it that's in common to all forms of fear? Why is it that this is something actually that we can eliminate from life. That's one of my conclusions. Mm-hmm. You can eliminate fear from life, but you have to understand what it is. And I think it is our emotional anticipation of the experience of unhappiness. We are looking ahead and saying, this is going to cause us unhappiness. I don't want unhappiness. I'm afraid of it. It's the similar thing for happiness is passion. When you anticipate that happiness is going to result, you get passionate about it. You get excited about it. You get enthused about it. All those are the same emotion. It's your anticipation of something wonderful is going to happen to you. And so fear is your anticipation something awful is going to happen to you, or even just minorly bad. I'm going to miss the first 2 minutes of the Super Bowl. And you have a very minor little fear about that, because what if somebody asks you about what happened in the first 2 minutes at work on Monday morning and you really can't say anything?
TiVo took care of that fear, right. So that's not an issue anymore.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's over. You just watch it on YouTube. So, but if that is what fear is, then to eliminate all fear, so that's my proposal, to eliminate all fear, you have to understand how to avoid all unhappiness. And what you're basically saying is to recognize that your body is not, whatever happens to your body is not the real thing.
I'll let me answer that specifically and answer another point, and then I'd definitely like to open up all of your questions as well. How do you eliminate fear? And I'll give just a short answer to this. To me, the key to eliminating fear is through understanding. It's not through manipulating one's thought or trying to organize one's life or trying to somehow manage things. The only way to get rid of fear is through understanding. The only way you're not afraid in the horror film is if you understand it was made on a soundstage in Hollywood. That's understanding. To me, the way I get rid of the fear, which I would posit is the source of so much discord in our experience, is through the same thing, understanding. And what I'm talking about tonight is a very specific kind of understanding, a theological understanding, an understanding of God that's been informed by one woman back in the 19th century that basically looked at all those healings with Jesus, kind of like Isaac Newton looked at the apple that fell and said, what's going on with that? Mary Baker Eddy looked at all those healings in the Bible and said, what's up with that? Was this some freak show? Is it some, you know, one-time exhibition? She said, no, there's something going on there. I want to understand what's going on there. And that understanding is what led to the reduction of fear, not only for herself, but folks who have studied and practiced Christian Science. So I would say that that's the key to eliminate fear, is understanding. And going back to your point about the body, you know, not lasting forever, you know, 150 years, okay, great. What I would say doesn't last forever, I wouldn't say it's the body that doesn't last forever. I would say that fear doesn't last forever, that ultimately we all understand what's really going on. That can't last forever. That fundamental fear, and we all have different fears, whether they're financial, bodily, whatever. Speaking from a religious perspective, I would say that the fundamental fear is that we're living a life separate from God, that he's somewhere doing something and we're somehow, some way separated, either doing things ourselves or somebody else did or he's doing whatever. But I think that's the fundamental fear, is that we're kind of leading a crapshoot, doing the best we can to get rid of as much fear as we can, to take care of the body as best we can. And that can be discouraging. And I'm speaking from experience. I'm not speaking as somebody who's, I have no fear. I get afraid all the time. Do I have bodily difficulties? You betcha. But I think at the root of that is this idea that we're leading a life separate from something it really is fundamentally designed to take care of its creation. So, but again, with that, I know you probably all have some questions yourself.
One thing, I'm on exactly the same page with you on understanding. I think it's the ideas that you have that make the difference in your emotions completely, mm-hmm. what your ideas are. So who'd like that to first?
A lot of questions. Are you tax deductible or reimbursable by insurance? Finally, what's your viewpoint on distance healing? And finally, last question, I do not believe that you can deny your children access to medical care. There have been some horrible cases of people that were praying and so forth.
Sure.
So what regarding your children?
Okay, I'll take those in that order. You ask about tax deductible and all that sort of thing. That's kind of a huge question, but I will say, for instance, if I'm going to pay for the services of a Christian Science practitioner or of a Christian Science nurse or nursing facility, that's a deductible expense according to the IRS and has been for 56 years. It's a recognized, legitimate medical expense. There are some insurance companies that will either reimburse for or pay directly to the insurance company. That's a smaller number since the advent of HMOs. But some major programs like Medicare, Medicaid or Medi-Cal here in California, TRICARE for military dependents, there's some big programs that have reimbursed or paid directly for those services that I described. So does that answer your first question? It was something related I was going to say about that, but I was going to say one other thing is HSAs, health savings accounts. You can pay for the services of a Christian Science practitioner, nursing services, from that account because those accounts are tied to basically what the IRS says is okay and has said is okay for the last, like I say, 50, 60 years. Your second question, I didn't hear the full question.
My
On what kind of healing?
Distance healing.
Oh, yeah. Okay, absolutely. No, thank you for asking that. Yes, all for it. working with patients myself, I don't require them to be in the room with me. We communicate via email, over the phone. What we're talking about here is a sort of a collective recognition of, again, divine mind. So does that know any borders? Absolutely not. I was working with somebody a while ago who was down in, not Costa Rica, Peru, somewhere. I mean, a long ways away. We had a wonderful healing together. So obviously, Miles had nothing to do with that. Your last question about children healing. True, the track record of Christian Science healing vis-a-vis children is actually quite good, very good. I can speak from experience. Being a child raised in a Christian Science household, my wife as well, there were maybe a handful of cases, I think 10 or 12 at the most, 20, 25 years ago, that involved a parent who did not bring their child to a doctor. They were Christian Scientists, and the child passed away. I would definitely describe those as anomalies. And there have not been, and some of those were prosecuted. There hasn't been a single prosecuted case for the last 25 years involving Christian Scientists. One thing I want to point out, though, and that's not to say, well, we get it, the track record's not perfect, but it's good enough that it makes sense for a lot of folks to stick with this. And again, they're not being forced to do it. They could bring their child to the doctor if they wanted. The church isn't dictating. One thing I want to point out, though, is there are quite a number of cases today. You may read in the newspaper, there's, again, about 10 or 12 cases in various states, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Oregon, Washington, where parents did not provide medical care to their children. Not one of those cases has anything whatsoever, theologically or otherwise, to do with Christian Science. That's part of my job, both legislatively and working with the media, is to make sure that there's not a conflation. Now, if something happens with a Christian Science family, absolutely, I'll own up to that and say, great, let's talk about it. But the cases going on right now, very unfortunate. But this conflation with Christian Science is an unfortunate as well. So for the, as far as the public having a clear understanding of what's going on. Did that answer?
Okay.
I'm interested to know the nature of the type of prayer that is used. Mm-hmm. A little bit about it, because I know there's like praise, adoration, petition, mystical prayer, and so
forth.
Contemplative.
Boy, you know, that's a great question. How would I characterize it? Because I'm not as familiar with, you know, intercessory prayer and this, you know, there's lots of different terms to describe prayer. I described it in my talk as fervent, humble prayer. Well, that may have not really described it very well. For me, prayer is based on, there's a citation, and for those of you who know the Bible relatively well, this citation will be familiar to you. It says, it's in Psalms, it says, "Be still and know that I am God." To me, that characterizes prayer in Christian Science. Be still. Let's let go of fear for a moment. Just be still and know, acknowledge, affirm, whatever word you want to use to describe it, that I am God. I'm omnipotent, omniscient. I know your every need. I'm omnipresent. I haven't gone anywhere. Let's spend a few moments just praying together about that. And let's see how that does for your fear. Now, is that a mantra? No, it's not a mantra. I've never prayed the same prayer twice, ever. I mean, I've recited the Lord's Prayer a bunch of times, but when I am working on a situation for myself, the prayer is never the same. So it's quiet, it's mental in nature, not a mantra. Does that kind of help in the point in the right direction? Okay.
My question is, if we are responsible for our own health and or God or both of us, mm-hmm. then the origin of actually being sick, who's responsible for that?
Mm-hmm. Great question. First of all, I would say that God is not responsible. The teachings of Christian Science teach that he's not responsible. There is that idea that God is, you know, either causes something or he allows it to happen. Most folks kind of fall in one camp or the other, religious folks. So I wouldn't say that he is responsible. I think fundamentally what's going on there, as I described before, is describe it as a mistaken belief, an erroneous belief that needs to be seen through. Does God send that there as a test? I'll go back to my sort of swimming analogy. I'm going to become a lot better person, less fearful, if I have opportunities to kind of work through these situations. Mary Baker Eddy in Science and Health describes it. She says, trials are proofs of God's care. Does it mean that he sent that trial? Well, go deal with this situation. No, trials, whatever that trial may be, financial, physical, or otherwise, are proofs, opportunities to prove that what we're facing here fundamentally is not real, is not lasting. What we're really dealing with here is not the situation, but a mistaken thought, this idea that we sort of separated ourselves, that we've done something to take us away from God. And again, does he send that? Absolutely not. I really do look at it as an opportunity to sort of assert who we really are as his creation. But that question, keep asking it, and I'm going to keep asking it, because that's my answer today. Call me tomorrow, and I guarantee you the answer will evolve. So we're all working it out. Last I checked, we're still here on Earth, so you know. Does that help?
Right, right. Or by God or whatever, when a person dies or gets worse or
yeah.
Whatever, then how is that explained?
I'll give a second answer. I told you I'd have a different answer, and you didn't even have to call tomorrow. And forgive me if this sounds, because I really don't want to talk around the question at all, but I'll share with you something that I found very helpful in my practice. If I'm confronted with a problem, whatever the challenge is, I go back to that citation in Psalms, be still and know that I am God. It does not say, be still and figure out the root of the problem, because when you do, you'll have a much better idea of what you're dealing with. And after you've done that, whether it takes 2 or 3 weeks, get back to me and we'll talk, for I am God. Now, I'm being flip, and I don't mean to be flip with your question, but the point is here, my healing work for myself and others is a lot more effective to the degree that I focus on what God is rather than trying to figure out the source of the problem. And the best example I can think of is doing math, okay? You write 2 plus 2 is 7, and your teacher slaps you on the wrist. Why did you write that? I don't know. Are you going to spend the rest of the afternoon trying to figure out why you wrote that? Where did it come from? I want to spend my time learning the law of mathematics so I don't make that mistake again. These are the best analogies I have. The best thing I can do, though, is working out in practice. And like I say, when I'm focusing more on what God is, what I believe him to be doing for me and for all mankind, for that matter, my healing's a lot more effective and efficient. The rest will come. Ultimately, I think we need to learn that all that mess, the discord, whatever you want to call it, really is a great big zero. But it's a step-by-step process.
Can you speak to the difference between Christian science and religious science?
Oh, yeah, sure. To whatever extent I can. Religious science, do we have any members of the Religious Science Church here tonight? Because I was going to ask you to stand up and probably provide a much more accurate answer. The Church of Religious Science was founded by somebody. It's traced to Christian Science in the sense that it was founded by somebody who was taught by another person who at one point was a student of Mary Baker Eddy, Christian Science. So there's sort of that connection, if you will. Is there any connection between the theology? There's some fundamental differences there. I think the most fundamental is that in the Church of Religious Science, teaches that it's sort of okay to work with both physicians and metaphysicians, that kind of working hand in hand is the most effective approach. But tracing it back theologically, the person who taught the gentleman who founded Church of Religious Science, she was somebody who completely disavowed any connection whatsoever to Christian Science way back in the late 1870s or 80s, mostly because she had a theological run-in, if you will, or contention with Mary Baker Eddy. Mary Baker Eddy, as I mentioned, was teaching exclusively from a Christian standpoint, whereas this woman, Emma Hopkins was her name, she believed that you can kind of mix and match Hindu, Buddhist, all different faiths into kind of one a homogeneous whole, and that should be the basis of one's teaching. And this student learned from her. So I would have to think that there's some element of that in Church of Religious Science. I should ask my uncle, though, because he's a minister of Church of Religious Science, and we just haven't had that many occasions to talk much about this, but thanks for your question.
There's one element of you know, what you're saying that I think everybody that's used the Monday Night Philosophy series would like to at least think about, and that is that if if life is a big zero, as you say, you keep saying it's a zero, it's a misperception, and this is true in several other mystical approaches to life, that life is somehow, human life doesn't really have any purpose, other than sometimes people say to teach you to come back to God, mm-hmm. to teach you this. But the point of it, especially for all those who fail at the game or the teaching, seems to be a big zero.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of hard to say that the purpose of it all was, you know, a big zero that I flunked.
Mm-hmm.
And it also kind of reflects back on, I mean, you say you don't want to look at you just want to know what the laws are. You don't want to analyze where they come from. But it really has a fundamental question about why was the game set up that way.
Right. And I to kind of go back on that point, I think the, you know, not wanting to deal with where it came from, I think to the degree that I actually focus more on the actual law, it makes whatever problem I'm dealing with a lot clearer. It actually is a more efficient way to understand that. Just like understanding the law of mathematics, you're much faster at detecting where the error is. I actually had a friend of mine who's is an engineer for Cisco Systems, really, really, really bright guy. And he wrote out this long equation that was not an accurate equation for his 10-year-old Sunday school student. Mm. Within 20 seconds, that Sunday school student went, boom, not accurate. You put a zero there like that, okay? So I got to think, what was behind that? Was it his analysis of this and that error? No, he understood the law of mathematics so well that he instantly recognized, I'm sorry, that's wrong, Mr. Cisco engineer, and just blew my friend away. So yeah. Anyway.
That's, we'll go into that. I find that fascinating, too. And it happened. But, questions?
Now, this is kind of more of a very personal question, just for you as a man.
Mm-hmm.
That has to do with my own difficulty understanding something about God. We have all these different religions in the world, mm-hmm. and it's, as we know, it's caused an awful lot of troubles.
Mm-hmm.
And just in Christianity itself, how many different versions do we have of what Christianity even is?
Mm-hmm.
Something I've just wondered, and I've wondered if you've ever had this question or wondered about it, is why doesn't God just clear it up? Why is he so mysterious?
Uh-huh, right.
He is omniscient. He's made everything. Nothing can really exist without him.
Mm-hmm.
And yet he allows this strife,
mm-hmm.
All this unhappiness to go on when all he has to do is let everybody know. He sends picks out individual people to talk to, like
right.
Abraham and Moses, and then you have to count on what they say, and mm-hmm. people don't.
Right.
You know, a lot of people, I don't think Moses was right.
Mm-hmm.
So have you ever contemplated such a thing, and do you have any idea why God simply won't let us know what's really going
right.
on?
Right, what's going on, yeah. Great question. And again, preface with there's lots of answers to that. Does he just let it happen? No, I don't think it's something that he does let happen. I think, I won't even say all too often, all the time, I think the answer is staring all of us right in the face. And for whatever reason, and I can't explain it necessarily, we choose to ignore that or disregard it or whatever the case. And I'll give you a very short example. 5-6 years ago, I was suffering from a pretty severe case of what, it wasn't medically diagnosed, but by all accounts, it was sciatica, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. It left me almost bedridden. I mean, I had to think before I got out of bed each day, and it was very, very difficult to walk. Did God send that? Did he cause it? What's going on? I'm a Christian Scientist, for gosh sake. I don't have problems. You know, I didn't say that to myself, but, you know, you go to this whole thing, like, where did it come from? What's going on? Well, in this case, the answer was staring me in the face, literally staring me in the face. Did I need to adjust my body? Absolutely not. Just through prayer, the idea that kind of popped into my head was this idea that I needed to be a lot more forgiving. I had kind of bought in. I was really keyed up at that time of the whole polarization, Republicans and Democrats and men and women. I was just this idea that we're just all stretched apart and we, you know, never the twain shall meet. I was just really struggling with that, and I didn't realize until I was sitting there praying to what extent all of these thoughts had just spun around in my head and literally spun me into a a state lying in bed. The answer was staring me in the face. Love a bit more, be a lot more forgiving. I did that, and within a very short period of time, the sciatica went away. It has not returned even an ounce of it since that time. That was 6 years ago. Now, that's one case. But again, and I would extrapolate from that, all too often the answer is staring us in the face. The situation in the Middle East, my gosh, a bit more forgiveness, a little flexibility, a bit of patience. Those are all things we're all capable of. We don't make them up. It's something God created us to be. And so I think to the degree that we exercise that, the other stuff is going to a degree, go away. So that's one answer. We've got somebody in the back there.
We're all capable of that, but our personalities also have the other elements that create all of the strife, and that may be a big zero, too, but it's a very obvious one. One time for one, well, it gets recorded. It gets recorded, so please use it.
I don't need it.
All right.
I really don't need that.
All right.
Just give me a chance.
Go ahead.
When I had my first heart attack, I laid in bed and said, I'm not finished yet. I have things to do. I have learned that after your first heart attack, you are probably going to live 25 years. Well, I'm 34 years older.
That's great.
Another thing is that I had a friend who turned 50 and was positive that he was old enough to die. And he kept saying this throughout, and he died before me. He did. Now.
Mm-hmm.
But I do feel that this has a lot to do with living in.
Yeah, definitely. Most definitely. Thanks for sharing that. If I could backtrack just a little bit, too. Again, going back to your point, George, about using this zero analogy, I don't want to give the impression by any stretch that we don't all, myself included, all of us, have some pretty serious situations to deal with, some of us every day. So I don't by any means want to dismiss that or marginalize that by any stretch, but I do want to emphasize the point that for me the most effective, efficient way to get to the bottom of that, if you will, is to focus on what I know in my heart to be true. And again, that's not positive thinking. It's just a practice that I've found to be effective. If it stops being effective for me, I might shift gears and try something else. It comes down to experience. If it's working, stick with it. If it ain't, think it through, try something else. You might come back, but it's for all of us. You can get a room full of doctors saying, do this, do that. You can get a room full of theologians, do this or do that. You know what? We all have to decide what's working for us and go with that.
That's a great end. A great talk. Thank you very much, Eric.
Thank you.
We also thank our audience here at the club, as well as those listening on the radio or online. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, held in its 108th year of enlightened discussion, has come to an end.
Thank you, George.
Thanks, Eric.